want your Stick to Wrestling podcast? Well, who am I to bring you down and not record one? Hello, everyone. Welcome to Stick to Wrestling. I am John McAdam. I am here with Sean Goodwin. I want to remind you that there are good podcasts out there, but there's only one wicked good podcast, and it's Stick to Wrestling. Give us 60 minutes a week, and we will give you a podcast zenith. This is the People's Podcast, and I learned this week it is an influencer. I would like to now bring on my co-host, my convivial co-host, who I have on good authority that he is not yet a person of interest regarding the fire at the Notre Dame Cathedral, Mr. Sean Goodwin. Sean, how you doing?
I'm already banned from France, so I'm off the hook. So, yeah.
Banned from France, Sean Goodwin. I like that nickname.
So what you're referring to is about our influences. I guess we've had a bunch of 1981 WWF videos being posted on YouTube recently.
Other stuff, but yeah.
Let's get to the – now, usually when I talk about the Facebook page, it's in vagaries. It's great. Come over here. I now have specific reasons now. I have specific stuff to tell you. Three things. First, we will be talking about a topic coming up, and that topic is being picked by one of our Facebook viewers, and that is because Don Carroll won the NCAA basketball pool. Actually, he didn't.
Now, in fairness, I won the basketball pool, but I already
knew
get to pick topics.
I've been
playing for 42 years. I've never won one, and I finally win one that has no cash prize, and what's being offered is something I do every week. That's just not fair.
So Don did get to pick the topic, and we'll get to that in a moment. The second thing is that coming up in – what is the date again, John? Is it May 7th, I believe?
It is Tuesday, May the 7th.
We will be having a what we call a group watch. This is basically where we'll all kind of sync up the whatever show we're watching, and then we'll all kind of watch it together and have a running commentary on it. It's a lot cooler than it sounds. And it's just wisecracking, funny, kind of just people giving memories about guys. It's a good time. So we'll be doing that. And what time is that? Is that 7?
We're going to be starting at 8 o'clock on Tuesday, May the 7th, which is the 30th anniversary of WrestleWar 89, and that is the show that we will be group watching.
And the last reason why, concrete reason to come over to our Facebook page is because that an argument that we started on the Facebook page will now be extended to the podcast. We were continuing our discussion from last week, and it kind of spilled over onto the Facebook page, which it often does, about my disdain for the WWF version of the Texas Deathmatch, or as I call it, the Park Avenue Deathmatch. And it's – so I found a video online that we posted, and we post a lot of videos on, but we found one online with Jim Cornette talking to Terry Funk, and Jimmy said – tell us what is the rules of a Texas death match. And Terry, who you'd think would know, since his father pretty much invented it, right?
That is my understanding. It is Dory Funk Sr. that came up with the entire concept.
Well, as you say, invented, what a Texas death match rule is basically the same exact rules as the London prize ring rules, the old bare knuckle John L. Sullivan rules, which is a guy goes down, you have a fall, and then there is a 30-second break. And then there is – after that, you have to start the 10, and if the guy can't get the scratch, match is over. And then you keep going. And at one point, I believe – and Terry talked about this in the clip – his father and Iron Mike DiBiase had it seems almost implausible. But you could see them doing to try to get the match over, this type of a match over, but had a 4-hour and 10-minute Texas death match.
Yeah, I think you'd lose the crowd no matter what.
I know, but it does give you that thing, even if it does lose the crowd, it gives you the idea that when they say this could go on forever, they could keep referencing that match, and they did.
That's a good point.
So now you disagreed with me, and I think I'm going to disagree with your disagreement in two ways, but please tell me why I'm wrong.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is very hurtful. I haven't even given you my rationale, and you're saying it's incorrect. But I can go back to 1979 when I was 14 years old, and I had extra money from God knows what, and I bought a money order for $50, and I got 50 back issues of every After magazine that I didn't have, almost every After magazine I didn't have. And in one of them, it explained the rules of the Texas Deathmatch, that if you are pinned or you submit, we take a 30-second break, and then you've got 10 to get on your feet. If you can't get on your feet, you lose. Even as a 14-year-old, I said to myself, okay, if I am in a submission hold that I would not ordinarily submit to, I would just say, I submit, let go. That's number one. Instead of using the energy to get to the ropes or whatever, I would just laugh and say, hey, I submit. I get 30 seconds. Number two, if I feel like I need a 30-second rest more than my opponent does, go ahead and pin me. I don't care.
Do you know
those are my two reasons?
Do you ever see those old bare knuckle fights where they'd see like 272 rounds and you're like, oh, that just seems impossible? Well, that's why, is because a lot of those rounds were exactly, it's part of the strategy. It's part of the strategy. Sometimes it's just better to, you know, take the fall. They did a similar kind of strategy. Do you remember the Iron Man match between The Rock and Triple H?
That was a really good match. Yes, I do.
It was a similar concept where they were using the fall strategically. I remember at one point Triple H got himself intentionally disqualified by waffling The Rock with a chair, and then turned around and pinned him.
Yeah,
I was like, that's brilliant. But you could do it. And that's what they did with the tag team match between Mantel and Lawler against Dundee and Landell. When you remember they had the 32 fall Texas Death Match.
That's
what they were doing, is that they were intentionally taking falls to take a break. But I have no problem with that at all. That's probably part of the strategy of the match. Plus, you could take a long match and you could start to break it up. You remember when I was talking about having a Broadway, you can always tell that if they do it right, they should be breaking it up into smaller matches. Well, you have an automatic format to do this.
I think on paper, the WWF-style Texas Deathmatch is the best one. They just didn't give you what they put on paper. They would have the referee breaking holds and stuff like that. I mean, I've seen shows from, you know, other promotions, like, you know, the Florida promotion had a Texas Deathmatch. That was just that. It was a Texas Deathmatch. Anything goes.
What New York – okay, now there's the second part where I'm going to disagree, because what New York did was not a Texas Deathmatch. It wasn't my argument against them – having, you know, advertising a Texas Deathmatch wasn't necessarily that they could do the rules different. It was not a Texas Deathmatch. It was a no disqualification, and it wasn't even that, because as you said, the referees kept breaking stuff up, but it was a no DQ match. One fall, no DQ. That's not a Texas Deathmatch. It's a one fall, no DQ match.
All right, but the counter to that is, by the time I got this back issue, I had already been reading all of the wrestling magazines for 3.5 years. I had been watching WWF for 3.5 years. And if something is a Texas Deathmatch to you for 3.5 years, and then you get this thing saying, no, this is what a Texas Deathmatch is, I would go as far as to say that it had evolved, it had changed.
What is the greatest Texas Deathmatch you've ever seen?
Oh, man. you're going to love me for saying this. Probably the Bob Backlund versus Ken Patera Texas Deathmatch from Madison Square Garden 1980. And you're right. It had the same WWF nonsense thrown in there.
That was a very good one fall, no DQ match. The greatest Texas Deathmatch that I've ever seen, and there's millions of these, not millions, but I mean, there's a ton of these not on tape. But the best I ever seen was Khan and Gordy.
Oh, that was a good one.
That's a Texas Deathmatch. That's how it should look. I mean, that was, I thought, I was 10 years old when I first saw that. I thought someone was going to die. I was like, my God, well, I'd never seen anything like that in my life. That was ingrained in my head forever. And I saw it years later. It was just as bad. I mean, as far as the islands of it. But that is... I like the way they can stretch those out. They can just kind of divide it up. You can have little mini matches. You can give the guys a break. You know, it's strategic points. I just like the way it allows you to set up the match. And it drives me nuts that they can't have, you know, they call it a no DQ match. Call it a New York street fight. They did that with the New York Street fight was more violent than any of their Texas Death matches. The one with Patterson and Slaughter.
Yeah, but there was a difference. The street fight meant that you came to the ring dressed as you are, and you know Slaughter would talk about how he was going to wear these big steel-toed army boots, and it was different.
Yes, in the Texas Death matches, multiple falls with a break between them. And, you know, that's what the Texas Deathmatch is. What they're presenting is something entirely different. And you saying that I was educated as it being something different. Well, yeah, that's because they did it wrong. That would be like if you went to Friendly's, ordered an ice cream. They brought you, like, a patty melt. And you said, well, no, I wanted an ice cream. They're like, no, but the patty melt's better.
No. It would be like if you went to Friendly's and ordered an ice cream in a different part of the world – and they gave you like a frozen yogurt type thing. It's like, that's what ice cream is over there.
Yes, but frozen yogurt and ice cream is like, they at least look similar. It's not a patty melt. I mean, there is nothing like a WWF Texas Deathmatch and the actual real McCoy. I mean, the only difference, like my other argument would be the break. And I insist the break should be, because when you look at it on paper, it's 40, if you're down for 40 seconds. There's really no weaseling out of that. It's not like the idea of like the old the chain matches. We have to touch all four corners, and they can never help themselves. On paper, it sounds good, but they couldn't help the cheap ending. They couldn't help doing the guy on the back tapping the corners as the first guy's tapping it and the next guy's right behind him doing it, or something dumb like that. Or with
they
the
always
cage,
had
same
cheap
thing.
Endings in the Texas Death matches, though. I mean, I can't say always, like going back to the 50s and 60s, but in the 80s and 90s, they certainly had shenanigans. Like the guy would get up, okay, match is ready to go, and then someone would knock him down when the ref wasn't looking, and oh no, he's down for the 10 count.
Yeah, those are all phony at that point. The last real one I'd seen was Gordy and Khan.
That was a great match.
Oh, that was brutal. And I'll see if I can find it and post it on the Facebook page. There you go.
All right. But there's a fourth reason why you should join our Facebook page. Stick to Wrestling. It's easy to look up. A gentleman named Kevin Ely this week told me the funniest wrestling story perhaps I've ever been told. It might be the funniest anything story I've ever been told. He described how in like the mid-late 70s, there was a wrestler in Mid-South named Dr. X who wore a white mask to the ring with an X on the forehead, right? And someone like busted him open with a chair or whatever, and he's got blood all over the mask, and he goes to the interview area, and he says that the mask is the only thing that's keeping his skull together. I'm still dying laughing at this. Like the mask is like a Band-Aid for broken skulls. And if he took it off, like half his head would fall off. It's assumed. And this guy's a doctor. He knows.
He's Dr. X.
Yes.
Dr. X, who was Jim Osborne, I believe. I believe this was the Tri-States area at this point. It's probably the late 70s. He had a feud with Murdoch, which that interview, all of a sudden, if you see him in a feud with Murdoch, all of a sudden it makes sense. It's like, okay, I can see someone having that interview with a feud with Murdoch. Okay, so we're eating at Dawn's time right now.
Yeah, well, you know what? Let me keep eating into Dawn's time. I just want to address two things really quickly. Number one, I'm not going to stick to wrestling for a second. On my way here to record this, I stopped at the supermarket, and the cashier says, "Hey, honey, how you doing?" And I'm like, "What?" Well, she wasn't talking to me. She was talking to the woman behind me. And the cashier says, "How many cartons of cigarettes do you need?" And the woman goes, I can't make the exact noise that she made, but she was a walking anti-smoking ad. Good God. And the second thing is, I just want to throw this out there. This mini controversy has been out there for like 2 or 3 weeks. Someone on Twitter showed that they have the famous Bret Hart versus Tom McGee match from, I think, 1986, where Vince McMahon became convinced that Tom McGee could become his new Hulk Hogan. And Tom McGee had an amazing physique. He had like a tiny little waist, but a huge upper body. And
think Kerry Von Erich.
Think Kerry Von Erich with a way smaller waist and probably bigger shoulders. I mean, this guy was a freak. And he could do a flip from the top rope, which no one could do back then. And Sean, I'm asking you, but I guess I'm asking everyone, like, do you really want to see this match?
I think it's going to be like every other Bret Hart match you've seen at that time. He was okay. The guy was good. The guy was legit good. I think maybe Vince underestimated Bret a little bit at that time. I think that's why the reaction was what it was.
Took him five more years to get to really push him at all as a single.
Exactly.
My take on it is, I wouldn't avoid seeing this match, but I don't really care. I don't know why it's such a hidden treasure for some people. I don't get it.
Because I think it's looking at it like it's a perspective thing. Because you're looking at it as Vince you're thinking Vince is looking at Bret as he would later come to know him. I'm thinking the reason that he made the move on McGee was because he didn't realize how good Bret was.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I've known about it for over 30 years. Yeah. I've never seen the match, but
I think you'll see a standard Bret match at that time, except he just didn't know it at that point.
Maybe. Like I said, it's just one of those things that, I mean, for the past couple of weeks, everyone's been hot and bothered about, and I just kind of shrug. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know.
No, I think you'd be underwhelmed, to be fair.
Okay.
So much has been built up. I think there's no way it could possibly be as good as, you know, as interesting as it's being said too. So, okay,
Dawn. I just don't have that curiosity level. That's what I'm trying to say.
True. Fair enough. I really don't either. So, but
all right.
Okay, Dawn. All eating up time is John's fault now. I'm trying to get to you here. What topic did Dawn pick?
He picked a couple, and we'll save. He asked me to tell a masked superstar story from 1983, which I will get to at the end. But the first thing he asked is he asked us to book Starrcade 82. So this would take place Thanksgiving night, 1982, and basically WrestleMania Zero, which would have taken place right around Final Four opening day in 1984.
Yeah, March 31st, 1984.
Okay.
In my genius, when we started to do this, I spent a lot of time, a lot of work. I put together a beautiful card, and then I realized that WrestleMania was in 1985, not 84. So I had to move up my beautiful card 1 year. So which one you want to start off with first, WrestleMania?
I think we should go in chronological order, and we should do Thanksgiving 1982.
Okay, now, we were talking back and forth earlier this week about this, and you said you had a difficult time with it. I did not, because, why did you think you had it? Why did you have a difficult time with it?
I didn't have a difficult time per se, but the reason WrestleMania, the 1984 WrestleMania was a lot easier for me is because, I was just living the WWF life, going to the shows, watching the two television episodes every Saturday, Mid-Atlantic, I've seen a lot of it. But not as it was going on.
Fair enough. The reason the Starrcade one was easier for me was because there basically was a Starrcade 82. Not to that extent, but Mid-Atlantic every year would have that show. That
they
super
had a
show,
big show
on,
in Greensboro.
On Thanksgiving. So, no reason for me to reinvent the wheel. I'm going to take a look to see what they did. So I did that. So how do you want to start these cards? From bottom up or from the main event down?
I would say bottom up.
Bottom up. Okay. I will start off with the Butcher and Cologne. I'm going to bring them in from outside. You wanted to have a nice big feel for the event. It's an international match, and you get them out of the way.
Okay.
Okay, are we going back and forth? Do you want me to just do the whole card?
I will have you do your whole card first because
that way
it's more linear, and then I will do mine.
Fair enough. Okay, and next up we have I got to use them, so I'm going to put Jimmy Valiant with Sweet Brown Sugar against Joe LaDuke and Dory Funk.
Okay.
Next up, I'm going to have Orton and Slater versus Jack and Jerry Briscoe.
Orton Slater. All right, that makes a lot of sense.
Coming up, I'm going to bring in a match from Mid-South, DiBiase and JYD.
Okay.
After that, I'm going to have Dawn and Sarge. I'm going to move this up a little bit. Dawn and Sarge against Ricky and Jay. I'll have McDaniel against Valentine for the U.S. title. Now, these last two were actually on the card. The last two I'm going to give you. I just basically stole them. I couldn't think of anything better. McDaniel and Valentine for the U.S. championship. And then for the world title, Ric Flair against Roddy Piper.
Okay, wow. Now, here's what I did. And I noticed just now I made a small boo-boo. We'll get to that in a minute. Opening match, Rick Rude against Joe Lauren. And it was Rick Rude at the very beginning of his career. And he was in the area. And Joe Lauren was, in fact, Joe Laurinaitis, a young road warrior animal. And I do this because I have the benefit of the time machine. Now, here's where I screwed up. Jimmy Valiant teams, like you did, with Sweet Brown Sugar, and I don't have opponents. Ken Timms and someone else. I don't know.
Steal mine.
I don't know why I did that.
Yeah, steal mine. You can have LeDuc and Funk.
No, I've got bigger plans for those guys.
Okay.
Next matchup. Now, I believe, next matchup is Les Thornton going after the NWA Junior Heavyweight title by wrestling Tiger Mask. And I don't think they don't have Thanksgiving in Japan, so he doesn't care about making the trip. Next up, we have the team of Jack and Jerry Briscoe against Joe LeDuc and Gene Anderson. Next up, and this is something I would absolutely fix. I'm not sure if I talked about this on the show before. I don't think I have. Dory Funk Jr. had a $100,000 challenge to anyone who could beat him. Now, even at the time I read about it in the magazines, I knew that was absolutely preposterous. I was, looking over career options at this point in my life, and I'm like, okay, you could be a doctor, a lawyer, a CPA, and it would take you 2 years to make $100,000. That's a really nice house and a Porsche. And Dory is offering it to someone just to beat him. Dory's got it laying around. No, no good. If I were booking this territory, it would be like at most a $10,000, which is still a ton of money back then.
Whose idea was that?
I would have. What's that?
Whose idea was that? I agree with you, by the
way. It was Dory. He was the booker.
Of course. Yeah. All right.
Yeah, of course.
Does he look like a kind of guy who would have $100,000 hanging around?
No, he was a former NWA champion, but that still doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, but he looks like someone's dad. That's a move that like Ted DiBiase is the Million Dollar Man or Bockwinkle or someone like that would make.
Okay, I could see DiBiase.
Dory looks like he drove up in his truck and, he does not look like a guy who's like $100,000. It didn't make sense with the guy. Like if Rick did it, okay, then I could see that. Rick looks like someone who would wildly overpay for something.
Okay, I can go along with that, even though still the amount is just too damn high. That is like more than three times what the average American was making every year, probably closer to four times. But anyway, Dory versus Wahoo for the monetary challenge. Next up, Mid-Atlantic title match, Paul Jones champion against Bob Orton Jr. challenger. I always have to do this. I always have to bring in Andre the Giant and put a big guy against him. So Andre the Giant against Bad Leroy Brown, excuse me.
By the way, Leroy.
He would have been a really good contender to bring up here against Bob Backlund.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree with it anymore. I liked him. He was big. He worked big. He could face or heel with equal ease. And the funny thing is, it's the same character.
Yeah,
he just looks a little crazier when he's a heel, but he's still the same kind of giggling kind of guy. But he just looks more like the Jack Nicholson character from The Shining when he's healing. But yeah, I think I absolutely agree with you. He'd be great to bring up for New York. He'd be like Joe LeDuc. I'd bring him up too. We've talked about that.
Oh yeah, same here. But I mean, that's just like another guy we throw in that he was perfect for New York. Why did it never happen?
Yeah,
thing. Like you, I have Slaughter and Kernodle against Ricky Steamboat and Jay Youngblood for the NWA tag team title held by Slaughter and Kernodle.
There's no way if that match is in the ballpark or it's feasible, you got to do it.
All right. And let me see. Ours are actually – and Steamboat and Youngblood were already a big-time tag team in Mid-Atlantic. They held the belts in 1980, yeah. Broke up for a while, and here they are back together. They were not a legendary team yet, but they were on their way, thanks in part to this feud.
Yep.
All right, next up, Greg Valentine defends his United States title against the American Dream Dusty Rhodes. And from there, Ric Flair defends his United States title against a longtime rival and your new red-hot babyface Roddy Piper.
Yeah, like I said, that's the obvious match for the main event. Let me go to your semi-main. I'm curious, how do you book that?
Obviously, this goes to a 30-minute draw. You have to protect both guys.
I was going to say, there's no way Dusty's doing a job, and you're not going to give the U.S. title to Dust right there. Not in 82.
No, and I'm also not going to do a DQ finish because Valentine had won the belt very recently, in fact.
So, yeah, those are both very feasible. I wanted to make sure I brought in something from the other, because that is the one thing the normal Thanksgiving Day card didn't have, and that was kind of the special feature that the Starrcade used to bring in the early days, was they would bring in matches from other territories. Like the,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, I just finished up there that they would just bring in matches from Florida, from Puerto Rico, from wherever, and it just kind of gave it a major feel. So I wanted to make sure I did one of those, or I did two
all right.
here, but.
Two things. Number one, my original card was Ric Flair against Dusty Rhodes and Greg Valentine against Roddy Piper, and I changed it not really last minute, but I wanted to have something that made it look a little bit more special. Number two, in the taking things way too seriously department, I didn't bring up anyone from Georgia because they had their own major event at the Omni at this point. And I didn't bring in Bob Backlund, listen to this, because I figured he'd want to stay home on Thanksgiving with his family. That's taking stuff way too seriously.
I think you're right on both points, though.
So, I probably am.
It's that is the thoroughness and the details that the stickers come to expect.
There you go.
From us. So, right, that works. I like those. So we want to go to WrestleMania. So this is what I had. Now, this was, again, a continuation. I just wanted to put a precursor when I did my earlier card for 83. I'm again trying to force that Dawn and Hogan title change match. But I couldn't do that here because Hogan would have already been the champion. That's why I sent, we were talking about that. But that was the match I wanted, was Hogan coming in against a heel Dawn. But this was too late to do that, so that wasn't possible. That would have been my ideal main event. But since I went first last time, please, sir, your WrestleMania event.
Okay. Now, this, like I said, it would have taken place right around end of March, early April 1984. Everything in the WWF is changing so quickly. I guess we've been thrown enough money. There's enough money thrown at us to have a major event in the middle of all of that. Here we go. The opener would be Brian Blair against Johnny Rods. Just a little thank you to Johnny Rods, who is going to be gone in about a year and has been there for almost 20 years. Blair was a good worker. Rods was a good worker. Should be a good match. Number two, second match down, the Samoans against the Invaders, something that we were supposed to see, and then the formula changed. But at least have the match because you've been pushing the Invaders on TV, and the Samoans are no longer champions. Samoans go over. Invaders are soon gone. Number three. Now, everyone's going to hear this match, and you're going to be all like, oh, my God, what's going on here? Let me explain. It is a six-man tag team match between Andre the Giant, Jimmy Snuka, and Chief J Strongbow against Dick Murdoch, Adrian Adonis, and Iron Mike Sharp. You're like, well, wait a minute. Two things going on here. Number one, this is Chief J Strongbow's retirement match, something I always thought he kind of deserved because he was a really big deal up here in the Northeast. Yeah, he stayed around too long, but at least give him a going-away party.
Absolutely. You're giving the people what they want, Jay's retirement.
There you go. The People's Podcast gives the people what they want. I didn't like the way he went out as just a fat old man doing jobs on TV, TV meaning primetime wrestling, or TNT at the time. And the reason Iron Mike Sharp is in there is I kind of ran out of heels and we need someone to do the job. Whatever. Next matchup, Sergeant Slaughter against Iron Sheik. We have to move up Slaughter's turn a little bit, but that's okay. We do things like that for WrestleMania. And this is not their Street Fighter, their boot camp match. This is just the first match in the series. You don't want to give everything away at WrestleMania, and people would still want to see it. Yep. Next match up, Bob Backlund against Greg Valentine. Backlund was still over in New York. They actually did this match in Madison Square Garden, April 1984. I saw it for the first time maybe a month ago, and I couldn't believe it. It was really good because Bob Backlund had stopped having good matches at this point, with this being the one exception. So I'm feeling good about this one. Next up, tag team titles. Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson, who were about to lose the titles to Dick Murdoch and Adrian Adonis. As a matter of fact, we're recording this Wednesday, April 17th, 2019. This is the 35th anniversary of Adrian Adonis and Dick Murdoch winning the belts. But we're not changing them here. We're going to go with Tony Atlas and Rocky Johnson defending against Paul Orndorff and Dr. D. David Schultz. Let me see. And like I said, because if everything happens at WrestleMania, that means nothing happens anywhere else, which leads me to my next match, Intercontinental title. Magnificent Morocco defends against Tito Santana. In real life, Morocco had lost it 6 or 7 weeks later. We put that off and we have our WrestleMania title change. Next up, second from the top, is Fabulous Moolah against Wendi Richter. We move up the whole Cyndi Lauper storyline by 3 months, which might have been tough because Cyndi was a big star by this point. She had stuff to do, but get her on a private plane, get her to WrestleMania like they did in real life, and have the title switch. Wendi Richter goes over. It's funny, I talked about that MSG show that I just saw from April 1984, and Wendi was still a heel on that show. It was crazy. And last up, I think it's obvious, Hulk Hogan against Roddy Piper for the WWF title. Now, you have to be really, really careful here because you're building everything around Hulk Hogan for the immediate and intermediate future at bare minimum. You are also doing the same thing with Roddy Piper, yet each of them had only been in the WWF for about 3 months at this point. So, like I said, you have to protect Piper to death, and I would have a run-in finish where Paul Orndorff and Dr. D. David Schultz, who were managed by Piper, do a run-in, Andre evens to the sides, and here's where I go a little bit too far with the Chief J. Strongbow thing. Strongbow comes in and starts tomahawk and chop guys, and they sell for him, and his career ends on a very happy note.
Stop it! You are not going to do that!
You know what? I'm really not. In real life, I would seriously consider it, but there's no way I'm giving that spotlight to a guy I'm never going to use again.
Oh, my God. I was like, oh, my God.
But I thought about it.
It took me a second. I'm like, is he serious? He can't be serious, right? But knowing your love of Chief J, I wasn't sure. Now, before I start mine, a couple things.
Maybe when the cameras went off the air, I would do that at Madison Square Garden. Now I'm being serious. Okay. I very well might do that.
That you could, I still think they'd laugh at you, but that's fine. You can do that. Jay's what, 72 at this point?
71 and a half.
Okay.
And that's his waist size, too.
Two things that okay. First of all, before I do mine, I just want to make it clear that we did not share these events ahead of time. You have no idea.
No, we did not.
Okay. Two is talk about the difficulty of booking snooker here.
I'm glad you asked because I wanted to have the Samoans in that match with Andre Snuka and Strongbow, but in 83, they did Andre and Snuka against the Samoans in so many times in so many different ways. There's no way I felt like I could have brought it back.
But it was kind of in limbo you know, right around this time up until almost the end. I mean, it just,
really. He was a little bit in limbo like April 84, but then right around May, June is when they did the Piper angle. And Piper and Snuka were main eventing around the horn, like in major arenas.
And they got Snuka out of there so fast once they shifted to Hogan. They had him as a guy come into the ring with them, but I mean, that was it. It was obvious that they were using Snuka to get Piper to Hogan.
I think they were just giving Snuka, who was still over like crazy, a major feud. I mean, if they're giving you a feud with Roddy Piper, they're giving you something good.
Right, but if you got to get Piper over as a monster heel, who are you going to have him go through? It's a Chief J rule.
You know what? I don't know what the original plan was. I know that in the middle of it, because Snuka needed to go to rehab, they did an angle, I think it was at Madison Square Garden, where Piper, you know, smashed a chair up against Snuka's neck and put him out of action, which made Snuka look really weak, by the way. The whole Piper thing made Snuka look weak from beginning to end. But, I mean,
that's my point.
Yeah, I think at that point, I'm not sure what was going on behind the scenes. Maybe they were starting to lose faith in Snuka. Maybe he really was starting to cool off. Maybe they just said, okay, we'll feed this guy to Roddy Piper.
So the other thing I noticed was that, I'll ask you about this. Did you see a dearth of faces here? Over faces?
Oh, yes.
A horrible time finding faces to run out here.
I ran out of heels. I looked up and I didn't see like Mass Superstar around at this time. So it was either, I mean, everyone was so new, and basically you had a lack of guys that were available to do jobs.
Superstar was there.
In March.
Oh, I double checked.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
Backtracking, I think he was still hanging around, but Bill Eadie was, or at least there was a rumor that Bill Eadie had left and someone else was the Masked Superstar.
All right. Either way, I'm right. When you see how I use them, I'm rolling them out again.
All right.
So with my event, of course, MSG, because you have to. And we will start with the Battle Royal. Again, I don't like them because I don't like how they did them. I think it can send a nice tone and it gives the event a big, kind of big feel for it, and you can kind of do some stuff later on. On this one, I like Battle Royals when the Battle Royal has a purpose. You remember when they had the Royal Rumble where Austin kept like heaving people out and he would just sit there on the turnbuckle waiting, and it kind of really put over Steve, and they did the same thing with Nash too?
Uh-huh.
If there's a purpose to the Battle Royal, I like them. If it's just, okay, let's have a Battle Royal and you have every mid-card guy in the world in there, then I don't. I have a point here. Greg Valentine goes over convincingly. I even have a couple of people getting injured, like a couple of mid-card guys here. I'm setting him up as just a monster, like a big-time heel, setting him up for both Tito and Hogan.
Okay.
Next match up, I have the Masked Superstar and Dr. D against Ivan Putski and Bruno.
Oh.
I am bringing back Bruno for a one-time event, and this way I can, you know, I can basically focus on, and it doesn't matter. He doesn't really have to do any heavy lifting here. You know, I mean, he was still running out good matches a couple of years after this. But, I mean, have him, Putski, and I think that would be a good heat match.
There's a problem.
What's that?
Bruno Sammartino and Vince McMahon, or the WWF in general, were completely on the outs at this point, if I have my timeline correct. I think he came back, like, summer or fall of 1984, but I guess for creative purposes we could move that up.
Yeah, and you took a couple liberties with Vince's relationship with guys here too. So I mean, I'm booking it, not Vince. So I'm not worried about that. So I see what you're saying.
You know what?
Though.
Here's
not
the thing: you make nice with Bruno a few months earlier. It makes sense.
Exactly. You have a big event coming in, and then you know. So and they did end up bringing Bruno back. You know, right around when the first WrestleMania was. So.
Oh, yeah, he had been back, like I said, I want to say summer 1984, he was back on TV, and he was there for like four more years.
I'm guessing if you had a big event coming up, Vince is making nice with Bruno again. Especially
yeah, and Vince Senior is still around at this point too.
Sheik Slaughter, and I agree with you how I book it. You know, you don't want to get you have like 15 blow off matches here. But yeah, I would have this like in the kind of sort of beginning ish when it just started to take off a little bit, maybe have a no DQ stip, but this is kind of like, Ricky and Jay against, Dawn and Sarge. If it's there, if it's close, you got to do it.
Yeah.
Next up, when looking at results, I surprisingly noticed that John Studd was there.
He was still there. Yeah.
Yep. John Studd Andre. Why not?
The only reason why not is, and this confused me a little bit at the time, John Studd came in the end of 82, had his run against Backlund, then in 83 went around the horn against Andre. And so basically they had already done Studd Andre less than the year before at Madison Square Garden. Now they still were doing it, but they were doing it, to kick off like the, they would basically when the WWF debuted in a new market, you would see Hulk Hogan against whoever and Andre and Studd, and this market had not seen that before, so it worked. But I'm not sure about New York at this point. I mean, then maybe, again, they did it on cable TV, so I don't know.
Yeah, I would say because this isn't the main event. If it was the main event, I'd say okay. But you're in the middle of the card, you know. And you've probably noticed I like 7-match cards. I think that's a nice number. You have a little leeway
and you know
to have
what?
Longer matches here and there, so.
Yeah, the other side of the coin is I burned Andre in a 6-man tag, so maybe you do have a better idea.
True.
And this is a coach-to-coach event, so.
Yeah, put a stip on it or something like that. You have to use Andre, and it has to be some guy big. I guess I can use Superstar, but, you know, I don't know how much Edie's going to love that. Because at the time, Edie was a bigger star than Studd, wasn't he?
Oh, tough to say.
We're talking 82 or 80. No, 84.
Yeah.
Was 84. Yeah. That's close.
Yeah. Superstar had already started doing jobs around the horn. It is really hard to say. I would say, you know, nationally, definitely Mass Superstar, but WWF wise, it's close.
Maybe. Yeah. Okay. Next up, I like this one. So basically, I'm looking at the this is think of how the main event played out in the original WrestleMania. So as opposed to having a tag team match, I kind of went, I don't want to give it too much away, but basically I found myself with Paul Orndorff and Jimmy Snuka available. So I'm sitting there thinking I'm going to have something to tie these two up so they don't interfere in what's coming up. So have these two in a strap match.
Uh-huh. So you have some angle early on with Orndorff, and now he's feuding with Snuka. Sounds good.
Basically, Orndorff is Piper's guy, Snuka's Hogan's guy. So Snuka's taking this match to get rid of Orndorff to protect Hogan.
Okay.
That's what I thought they should have done in the original, looking back on it, as opposed to just having everybody at ringside use those two guys. You could have had, like, you know, Orton and Snuka, which would have been, you know, I'm fine with that.
They had just done Orton and Snuka like 3 weeks earlier, I want to say, at Madison Square Garden. But, I mean, you could have held that off, obviously.
Sure, yeah. I'm just saying, I just didn't think the point of having them at ringside. It would have been more interesting to take that, you know, worried about the two guys and use it constructively.
Good point.
Okay. Next up, we got the IC title match. I am not happy about this. I wanted Morocco in the main. The more I'm thinking about it, the more I like that match. But I'm stuck with this one. So, and I love this match. I've seen this match, and it's fantastic. IC title match, Morocco, Santana, Cage. Santana goes over. Same reasoning as you. It just makes sense. These two had great chemistry together. It would be a great match. Well, Dawn may brood because he's third from the top. But, I mean, Dawn was always a big card guy. I mean, you know, whenever it was like a big, massive event, Dawn had his problems when it was like – if it was a smaller crowd, like a high school, nothing going on, you know, whatever. But when the lights were on in the big event, Dawn was usually great.
There was an exception. And I think I've mentioned this on the show before. I'll keep it brief. But I was at the Boston Garden when Tito Santana won the Intercontinental title for Morocco, and it was never put on TV. The rumor is that something happened with the tape or something like that. The match was just beyond terrible, and I bet they just said, forget it. We'll just air the finish, and that'll be it. I don't know if Morocco just, like, went into a funk, didn't want to lose the title, whatever, but the match was awful. I mean, exceptionally awful.
That's fair. But, I mean, again, this – I don't know. It's – you have to – maybe if you promise, like, Dawn to give him a run, I don't know. I think I can work around that because if Dawn doesn't feel like he's getting the appropriate push, he will occasionally, as you just said. That's the bad Dawn I'm talking about. If Dawn's not getting
Morocco,
what – yeah.
I think, like, right around, you know, at some point in 84, he went away for a while. He went home to go surfing and came back with Mr. Fuji as his manager and had the run against Hogan. So, I mean, it all worked out. I can't tell you why that match was so bad.
He wasn't the same guy when he came back.
No, he wasn't. And, yeah. I mean, you know, this is a time
good,
where
but...
you know, my friends and I didn't talk about match quality for the most part. If you were in, like, that top 5% of matches, wow, that was really good. If it was like bottom five, wow, that was really bad. This was like bottom 5%. I'm not kidding.
Yeah, I think that still could be a pretty good match, though. It's a Dawn thing. If he does, you know, as you said, he probably went in the tank because he's getting phased out, and that, you know, I could see that happening. But I think if you could phrase this right, that's why I'd love to see him in the main. If he was in the main event here, it'd be great. Okay, tag team title match, Adonis Murdoch, Atlas Johnson. I love Adonis Murdoch. They were my favorite team.
Oh, they were a great team. Great, underrated team. Best tag team the WWF had ever seen at this point.
Yep, the North-South connection, they were fantastic. They were absolutely my favorite tag team as a kid. Right up until Barry and Mike Rotunda, the U.S. Express. So I would do, yeah, I'd roll out Adonis Murdoch, Atlas Johnson. You're covered because you have the main event, so I have Adonis Murdoch go over right here.
And have him win the titles right there?
Yep.
Makes sense. Got to do it.
And then the world title, that's how good Roddy was. He's in both. He's in the main event of both of them. Hogan against Piper, you got to do it. And sorry, Rod, if you want to make it like this kind of brutal fight, have things go against him, whatever like that, fine. But Roddy's got to do a job here. I mean,
ooh,
you
I bet he wouldn't
give him. You know what? You're in this. Let's see how much money you want to roll on. If you want to like couch it a little bit, fine. If you want to have like something, you know, something backfire at somebody else's fault, like it ended up being, that's fine too. But I mean, come on. It's like the major this would end up being the major event in one of the top five events in wrestling history to that point. You can't have a disqualification or something stupid in the main event.
You know, that's a good point. If I put that before having the biggest match, then I would have had someone else in the main event. Because that's how much I think Roddy Piper needed to be protected at this stage of the game. By the way, I mean, think about this. Roddy Piper, unless I'm forgetting something, never did a high-profile or even a medium-profile job in the WWF until he lost to Bret Hart in 1992 when the WWF was just a completely different thing.
Okay, this you can't have a – think of the Starrcade 97. Okay, you remember the main event, Hogan and
– I am afraid I do.
Yeah, okay. I'm telling you, if they had a clean finish in that match, that card looks all kinds of better. That just left such a rancid taste. I'm not saying it was great, but I'm saying that ending was so bad. That it's just what happened? You just killed Sting dead. So anyway, off of that, but you got there has to be a way to have Roddy, you know, like do some kind of a job here and, you know, have him somewhat protected. But you can't have a DQ here. It's terrible. And that's your number one match. So I mean, it has to be a stipulation or some kind of a stip way of handling this.
Like I said, you're having a difficult time booking this match because of the timing of it. And like I said, you know, on one hand, yeah, you want to have a real finish to this show. You know, it's the main event. On the other hand, you have to protect Piper. I mean, you've got so many eggs in his basket long term.
I can't buy not having a title match here. I think that was a problem with WrestleMania. That was the problem, only problem with WrestleMania, the first one, was that you did not have a title match. You cannot have a major event and not have a title match of your major title.
I mean, but they did. It was a huge success. And by bringing in Mr. T, who, by the way, has had a really kind of weird relationship over the years. I mean, about 10 years ago, Mr. T was like, you know, he was back in. People thought he was cool again. By the late 80s, there was nothing less cool than Mr. T. But right now, he's still pretty over. And getting him in the main event, I think, was way bigger than people think of it today. I think having him in the main event was bigger than the WWF title. And again, you know, I get it. But you can't have like Mr. T and Jimmy Snuka or JYD and then have Hogan defending the belt. You had to have Hogan and T together.
Oh, well, fair enough on that. But it's okay. Now, I will give this proviso here, is that Vince McMahon is a far better promoter than I ever will ever consider being. And what I'm giving you right now is a purely aesthetic card as far as the wrestling quality. Of course, what Vince does is going to make more money than what I'm thinking.
Vince had bookers, not true, you're the booker here, not the promoter.
But I think that is your, and I think it would have been a bigger event if you could just had Hogan, Piper straight up. Or there has to be a way to do this. Hasn't this been done before, where you have a main event like this and you could, you know, have a main event of this? How about a draw?
I'm going through. I think a draw would be the least satisfying of all.
How about if you did a draw where, you know, say someone did get interfere and did get to Hogan, and Hogan's able to make it to the buzzer?
I mean, maybe, but you know, I'm going through like main events on major shows in my head, and I'm trying to think of one. That I'm talking, you know, the kind of WrestleMania show. At the 1976 Shea Stadium show, Stan Hansen didn't get pinned. I think he got counted out, which set up the cage match. But I mean, I don't remember anyone complaining about that. But then again, I was 10, so what do I know?
Well, I mean, okay, maybe I could deal with a count out, I guess. But I mean, it would have to be somewhat of a. I hate having cheap losses at the end. And yeah, that has to be the match.
I would have done what I did. I mean, I would have had Schultz and Orndorff do a run-in, have Andre do a run-in, and now you've kind of cemented that whole, like, Piper stable thing, which they got away from, which I don't know why, but I could see, you know, now you've established, okay, you've got Piper and his gang at the top.
And the other issue is the fact that if you're looking at Hogan and Piper, what's the weight difference at this point? 70 pounds? 80?
Tremendous height and weight difference between those two.
And Hogan can't go over this guy?
They protected Piper in real life,
that's,
and it worked. You
yeah,
know? You
that's,
needed
I
that,
know, but...
You needed that lead heel, and I think I honestly think when Piper turned babyface, and they really didn't have that number one guy to replace him, I think it hurt the WWF. I really do.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
And they had to turn him at some point. They had to turn him. You could argue that they waited too long to turn him. Now, Don asked the second question. And before I get to my NAS superstar thing.
Yep.
He has 70s and 80s wrestlers who were most ahead of their time and floundered hardest as a result. Do you have any ideas?
Chris Colt.
Okay, there's one. I haven't seen much of Chris Colt, I will be honest. But, I mean, I know his gimmick was way ahead of its time. Here's one for me. And I can't think of anyone who really floundered. I think Colt kind of did, but a guy who was ahead, so ahead of his time that it held him back, I'm going to say Ken Shamrock.
I almost want to say Ken Shamrock was a little – I think Ken would have worked better earlier.
Ooh, because earlier means that UFC was nowhere near as big a thing as it was in the late 90s or today.
Fair enough, but stylistically.
Yeah, I mean, you look at what they have, what they had apparently with Brock Lesnar for a long, long time, granted part-time and on and off, but he was over like crazy. And Shamrock could have been the babyface version of that, and he worked full-time. But he still, you know, I don't think they ever pushed him right to begin with. But at the same time, I think he's someone I felt was ahead of his time, and it hurt him.
And here's another one who took – I'm stretching Fondering here, and this kind of gives me a chance to bring these guys up because I like these guys.
Okay.
Fondered because the realism of the era and what they were doing ended up coming too close. Oh, a quick thing. For those who don't know Chris Colt, aren't familiar with him, think Brian Pillman before Brian Pillman. And Chris did well, and he was successful, but – if you look at him, he was – like he had some – there's some tapes out there of him in the mid-70s in Memphis with some matches with Bill Dundee. And he is fantastic. I mean, he is crazy. I actually wrote this thing down about Colt. Here was a – this is a quote from Jim Cornette talking about Colt. This is word for word. Colt was, for the time, on the smallest side for a wrestler, 6 feet, maybe 210, 220, but he was perpetual motion. On offense, all of his stuff looked good and snug, with no mistakes serving as a buzz killer. His body language and facial expressions were just right for any situation. At one point, Roughhouse Fargo whacks him over the head with a chair so hard that the seat flies up or the chair horse calls him around the neck. Colt then stiffens up, takes a few rubber-legged steps toward the ropes, and flies over the top rope to the floor with the chair still around his neck. Moments later, he's arm-whipped into the turnbuckles, does a flawless high-speed upside-down bump that would have made that move's innovator Ray Stevens jealous and put to shame the versions by Flair and Shawn Michaels that modern fans recognize. He ran from the heroes like a coward, cheated whenever he got the upper hand, and worked the fans like a maestro at the same time. If you put him in the mid-90s, he's a superstar.
Okay. Yeah,
or even
you know
now.
What? You brought up Pillman. I mean, Pillman, it wasn't the reason he floundered, but he was definitely ahead of his time. But anyway, we are near the end of the show, and I do, because Don is a huge Mass Superstar fan, I want to share something with him that is not available on video anywhere. We went to the Boston Garden the Saturday before Columbus Day. In 1983, when Superstar was getting his big push, Superstar had injured Bob Backlund protege, Eddie Gilbert, with the corkscrew neck breaker. And Bob was defending the title and looking for some revenge. And they had the match, and Superstar won by countout. And then they did a thing where Superstar laid out Arnold Skoland, just like dropped him on his keister. And by the way, Skoland was hardly ever at the Boston Garden with Backlund. Then he grabs Backlund outside the ring and does the reverse, the corkscrew neck breaker to Bob so that they landed on Arnold Skoland. And the place, talk about a place going bananas, because we never saw anything like this. Backlund was already starting to lose, had already kind of lost some of his appeal. And I mean, the place went crazy. They were cheering when both Bob and Arnold Skoland were carried out on stretchers. So there you go, Don. There's your Mass Superstar story that only 13,000 people saw, and that's probably a whole bunch remain around anymore. This concludes this week's Stick to Wrestling. It is always the fastest hour of my week. Sean, thank you very much for all you do for Stick to Wrestling.
Thank you as well. And thanks to everyone on the Facebook page, everyone who's listening, and everyone who's listening not on the Facebook page. You should be on the Facebook page.
You should be on the Facebook page. I think you'd enjoy it. I got joined Facebook kicking and screaming like 3.5 years ago, and I don't tell anyone in my life that I'm on there. I just use it for wrestling groups. I also want to thank Lou Kippelman for producing this show, as he does every week, doing a marvelous job and helping us out as the show is going on. And Stick to Wrestling is a presentation of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. We will see you all next week.